different than, and it's attacking a different location than the original competitive inhibition. The competitive inhibition is, of course, directly acting on the free enzyme. And what you follow, brother, what we find here is that the uncompetitive, the inhibitor is acting at the enzyme substrate level. So the substrate is allowed to, in fact, bind to the catalytic site, but at a different site, the inhibitor binds to the enzyme and blocks its action. That's kind of why they call it uncompetitive. It's because the inhibitor is attacking a different location. So if you have an enzyme, something like that, if you have an enzyme, your substrate will be here, and that would be the normal circumstance. But in uncompetitive, there's another separate location in which the inhibitor attacks. But when the inhibitor is located there, it turns off the entire enzyme. And that's an uncompetitive model. That's the model for the uncompetitive inhibition. Nevertheless, you have this ESI, and once that inhibitor is in place, there's no reaction. It simply reduces the amount of ES available to produce the product. And there's less ES available, and your product slows down. The algebra, again, to describe this is beyond the scope of our discussion here. However, suffice it to say, in the Michaelis-Menten equation, the alpha in this case is given a prime term, alpha prime, to distinguish it from alpha, and is now multiplying the S value, the substrate value, in the Michaelis-Menten equation. Doing the algebra to manipulate it to make it the Lineweaver-Burk plot equation reveals that the alpha prime now is located as a numerator in the beta, in the B term of the slope of the linear equation. And, of course, that's the y-intercept. And you can see immediately the effect of having a changing alpha on the y-intercept is to produce a series of parallel lines. They don't have to be three. They can have many of them, but the series of parallel lines. So whenever you see a plot of the Lineweaver-Burk plot that's parallel, immediately you should recognize that as being uncompetitive, and the inhibitor is in fact attacking the enzyme substrate, a complex directly, and attacking that and creating a trimeric complex that does not go on to complete the reaction. As you can see here, the alpha prime again is given a peculiar terminology where the K prime exists now as opposed to K in the competitive form. And much of the information is the same. Again, you see of note that the lowest or the smallest, the one closest to the zero, the line closest, I guess, but closest to the y-axis, that particular line is the uninhibited form. So you can see, again, the uninhibited is the lowest here, and you can see that the uninhibited is the flattest here, and you need to recognize that as being a part of the matrix, and that's pretty much 100% all the time. There are no exceptions to this. So that's uncompetitive. So you need to link again the shape of the plots to the Lineweaver-Burk equation and to the Michaelis-Menten equation, and then also to the kind of mechanism they're talking about. All that information needs to be linked in your brain in terms of being able to coordinate and recall those and be prepared to answer questions about it. All right, and the last one here is got two names. Yay! The most accurate name is mixed inhibition, or as was known originally, non-competitive, which is even a worse misnomer than uncompetitive. Non-competitive in this case mixed inhibition. Mixed would imply that the same inhibitor acts on either the free enzyme or the enzyme substrate, and that's absolutely the case. This is a very common inhibition to have, And you can see here where you can produce the unreactive enzyme inhibitor complex or the unreactive enzyme substrate inhibitor complex, both of which go on to Mo equation. The algebra, again, that produces then the Michaelis-Menten equation from this has an alpha in front of the Km, an alpha prime in front of the S. And when you do the mathematics to produce the Lineweaver-Burk, you see that there's an alpha as a part of the slope, and then an alpha prime as a part of the y-intercept. Therefore, you get an interesting kind of situation in which the slope is changing, and also the y-intercept is changing. And you can get a variety of different alpha primes, alpha and alpha primes, and you can get a variety of K and K prime inhibitors. This is the most common of the three enzymes like to play games with biochemists, and of course they make their lives not all that simple. So you find that this is the most common because enzymes are complicated. One of the other interesting sub-classifications of mixed is this, and I've seen this on questions, not necessarily one I'll give you, but I've seen on questions. I apologize for the slope. There are no slopes in these lines. But they sometimes come up with a particular and peculiar kind of exception in which there is there's an enzyme in which all these lines meet on the Km. So there's not a difference. So the Km and the Km apparent, the Km for, let's see here, the Km, there are not two different Km's in this value right here that you see. There's not a changing Km. They all meet here. So this kind of plot in which these things meet at the Km on the x-axis is in fact a mixed inhibition, but it's a very specialized and unusual. They almost have to create a fake enzyme and give it some fake numbers to get this. It's very unusual that this happens. It's primarily just where they meet here above. There's a point of inflection or a point of fulcrum here above and to the side of the x-axis and the y-axis. Again, indicative of what kind of inhibition? Mixed. What's another name for mixed? Non-competitive. Yeah, I'm so sorry for that. That's just silly, but that's what it is. All right, so how are enzymes, in fact, let's see here. Do I want to go? Is there one more line on this? Can someone tell me? There's another line. And another line. I'm going to stop there. I'm going to press my luck there. Okay, well, how in the world are enzymes controlled? As you can see here, they're controlled by inhibitors that are present. But there's a wide variety of other types of controls that occurs. For bacteria especially, the enzyme availability is a very common way of controlling the rates of a chemical reaction that use enzymes as a catalyst. The enzyme amount that exists in a bacteria, of course, is the net amount of synthesis minus degradation. So the first two blanks you see there are synthesis minus, the next blank is degradation. The next two blanks are allosteric effectors, and the next blank is covalent modification. Covalent modification. So you see here where a very broad and relatively slow in eukaryotic systems is this enzyme amount, where you have an amount of synthesis minus the amount that's being degraded. And so there's that constant battle you find in the cell as it creates an enzyme and as other mechanisms reduce it. And depending on the circumstances in your physiology, you may be having an increased amount of enzymes, an increased amount of enzyme availability because you've increased synthesis, or by simply reducing the amount that you are degrading it. That's another way of increasing overall enzyme amount. Since this stays constant and degradation increases, is one way of getting increased enzyme amount. Primarily, however, for this class, we'll be looking at these last two ideas in which we're talking about allosteric effectors and covalent modification. When I talk about allosteric effectors, I say think about hemoglobin. Why would I think about hemoglobin as an allosteric effector? Well, what is the effect of oxygen? The binding of the first oxygen to hemoglobin does what to the binding of the other oxygens? Yeah, it increases it, makes it easier. So that's a very common allosteric effect. It's not a covalent bond. It's not a bond that requires an enzyme to attach it or an enzyme to break it off. That's really the foundational idea with the covalent modification. But it's small molecules that simply attach to another location on the enzyme and slow it down. So you can see here, I mean, if I took an enzyme, okay, and I have where the substrate fits, and I have where the inhibitor fits, but there may be a separate location entirely here where an allosteric effector attaches. So here you might have an allosteric effector come in, and as it attaches, it actually slows the enzyme rate so that the substrate production, consumption drops, or the production of the product drops, simply because the conformation of the enzyme has been changed because the allosteric effector is modifying its shape. And notice, the allosteric effector typically is binding a separate location than the actual substrate. It's not a competitive inhibition. It is literally a modification of the activity of the enzyme by conformational changes. Another powerful modification that can occur is covalent modification. These, of course, require enzymes to add the covalent modification and enzymes to remove the covalent modification. You studied that, at least memorized it, when you were looking at the glycogen synthesis regulation pathway. And when we get to that, we get to see part of it today. When we get to that, you'll see what in the world we're talking about. So let's focus on allosteric effectors. Well, allosteric effectors are the classic idea behind feedback inhibition, where a product, either partway through a pathway or at the end of the pathway, returns and binds at a location other than the active site, and that binding, which is, of course, non-covalent, distorts the active site and slows down the enzyme. So here you have, this is a pathway that we haven't talked about at all. It's the production of this CTP, which of course is an important nucleic acid. It begins with something called carbamoyl phosphate and aspartate, and it has an enzyme called ATCase. ATCase is another way of saying it. Produces an intermediate in there called N-carbamoyl aspartate. You have six more chemical reactions that go on to produce the final product. But that final product, once its concentration increases in the cell, returns and acts on a site other than the active site at that ATCase and slows down the enzyme. That's a classic feedback inhibition. Classic feedback inhibition. And you can see that here where you have with the purple line, there's no allosteric effectors. And with the CTP present, it shifts it to the right, which slows the enzyme down and reduces the overall production of the material of the pathway. So feedback inhibition, allosteric effectors, you're going to see dozens of allosteric effectors in the next few weeks. All of them very important for metabolism. Okay, now, let's take a look at some control of covalent modification. The most common, let's see here, run through this. How many more is there on this? A little bit more? Let's see here. And do I actually, oh yeah, there we go. Okay, so this particular diagram, I don't think I put this on the metabolism quizzes to memorize. Is it? This is not one to memorize in terms of metabolism quizzes. This one, however, plays an important role in looking at the relationship between covalent modification and allosteric control, it has direct relationship to the amount of glycogen in your liver. Let's take a look at this. This is dealing primarily with covalent modification. Phosphorylation and dephosphorylation is the most common form of covalent modification to affect enzyme activity. That is literally adding a phosphate and removing a phosphate. The presence of the phosphate alters the shape of the molecule and either slows it down or speeds it up. Typically, the phosphate has to attack an amino acid side chain that has an oxygen on it. And there are three that have an oxygen on it. Serine, threonine, and tyrosine. The enzymes that add the phosphate are called kinases. And the enzymes that remove the phosphates are called phosphatases. Phosphatases. So the model is here you have an enzyme called a protein kinase, and here you have a protein called protein phosphatase. If, for example, the enzyme is inactive and you add an ATP to a hydroxy group, you can turn the thing on to make it active. But notice that's a covalent bond. That's not going to spontaneously break. Therefore, you have to have a second enzyme called a phosphatase that removes it and restores the inactivity. There's also something about this diagram that's a little tricky. And that is there are as many enzymes that become active when you add a phosphate as those that become inactive when you add a phosphate. This model right here appears to say that adding a phosphate, all it does is activate an enzyme. That's incorrect. Adding a phosphate can also inactivate an enzyme. So you might want to put active underneath this in parentheses and inactive over here in parentheses. Because there are enzymes that become inactive when they get phosphorylated. All right, let's take a look at glycogen phosphorylase as a model for both covalent modification and allosteric control. Notice, if you would, what glycogen phosphorylase does is it takes glycogen and acting in concert with phosphate, with an inorganic phosphate, the glycogen phosphorylase is the catalyst that removes one of the glucoses from glycogen. Notice it says N-1, and releases a glucose 1-phosphate. For those of you who have not eaten breakfast, you're probably having some of this activity going on right now in your liver in order to dump glucose into your blood to feed your brain. Okay? This is occurring in the liver. It's not occurring in your blood, in your muscles, even though there is glycogen phosphorylase and glycogen stores in your muscle. Your muscle cannot directly provide glucose into the bloodstream. Only the liver can. So the glycogen phosphorylase enzyme is centered right here and is designed to produce glucose 1-phosphate, not glucose 6-phosphate, glucose 1-phosphate by breaking down glycogen. Let's look at this model, ladies and gentlemen. It is a compact yet highly information-dense model. I want you to note down here at the bottom, they have two forms of the enzyme called phosphorylase B and phosphorylase A. By your powers of observation, can you tell me the difference between phosphorylase B and phosphorylase A? Presence of phosphate on the enzyme. How did the phosphate get added to the enzyme? What enzyme added the phosphate to the glycogen phosphorylase? What's it called? Phosphorylase kinase. And it used up 2-ATP to do that. Now, in the reverse, and notice this is reversible, what enzyme is used to remove the phosphate? The phosphoprotein phosphatase. What? Why wouldn't you call it phosphorylase phosphatase? The reason why this is called phosphoprotein phosphatase is this particular phosphoprotein phosphatase is actually a part of a system that when activated removes phosphate from a variety of phosphorylated proteins. So there are a group of phosphoproteins that this phosphatase acts upon, one of which turns out to be glycogen phosphorylase. So now you have the two enzymes that are responsible for adding the phosphate and removing the phosphate. What is its effect? Well, notice here we have to also look at some of the arrows. Okay. Well, so we went vertically in this matrix, and we saw that in this vertical column, this phosphorylase B is not phosphated. And over here in this vertical column, the phosphorylase is, in fact, phosphated. But I now want you to note the horizontal rows here. Notice the square form is labeled as what? Inactive, and notice it says it's the T form. Here, the horizontal row is known as the R form and is inactive. Notice what happens here then. You can have a non-phosphorylated, the unphosphorylated phosphorylase both be in an active form and an inactive form. And you can have it phosphated and be in an inactive form and an active form. So you actually have four states for this enzyme. Four states for a single enzyme. Do you now understand the complicated nature of enzyme regulation? And this is just one enzyme with four possible states of being. So, notice the thickness of the arrow indicates the favored activity. So in this case, when you have the unphosphated phosphorylase, What appears to be the favored form when it's not phosphated, according to the arrow? The inactive form, is that correct? But notice I said the favored form. Does that mean that the inactive form, when it's not phosphated, cannot become active? Yes, it can become active. What appears to be the favored form when it is phosphorylated? The active. So unphosphorylated, the favored form is inactive. Phosphated, it's active, but that's not the entire story. Because both forms can be altered by allosteric effectors. So let's just pretend that you have this phosphorylase B primarily in the inactive form. It is not phosphated. What would be the energy state of your body, of your bloodstream, if this is the favored form? If the phosphorylase is inactive, what's the energy status in your blood? Is it sufficient energy, or is there a lack of energy in your blood? Let's use our critical thinking skills for that. I appreciate that answer. I'm glad you spoke up. Phosphorylase B, what's the purpose of phosphorylase? What does it do? It does what? No. Phosphorylase, glycogen phosphorylase, that enzyme is designed to do what to the glycogen? See? Yeah. See, notice how complicated this gets and how you have to pay attention to this. We're actually talking about, there are three enzymes on this diagram, aren't there? There are three enzymes. One of the enzymes has four possible states. The three enzymes are glycogen phosphorylase with the four possible states. The purpose of glycogen phosphorylase is the production of glucose-1-phosphate in the liver, which then gets dephosphorylated into glucose and gets dumped into the blood. In other words, whenever this glycogen phosphorylase is turned on, you're decreasing the amount of glycogen that's stored in your liver, and that glucose is going primarily in your blood. So the idea is here, when the glycogen phosphorylase is turned on, the liver is producing excess glucose, which gets dumped in the blood. So having glycogen phosphorylase turned on means that you have low fuel in your blood. All right? So let me ask that question then. Again, same question. You got an idea again. So here we have glycogen phosphorylase that's primarily in this form, which is in what? Inactive form. What does that say about the energy state of the blood? Is what? There's enough energy in the blood. So this is off. Okay. Well, that's great. Now, let's take a look at this. Oh, I love this. But at any rate, let's take a look at this. Notice here, we're just going to focus on this transition right here. Notice we have AMP. High levels of AMP can covalently modify that form and make it a what? Change it from inactive to what? Active. Okay. Why would high levels? Now, and notice what ATP and or G6P can do. It can then also, beyond having this as the favorite form, it can increase the amount of T form. Now again, what's going on? Here's the situation. High levels of ATP in the cell. Notice now I'm talking about a slightly different situation in the cell. This is dealing with the moment-by-moment metabolism within the cell. High levels of ATP indicate what in the cell? There's sufficient energy or not sufficient energy? If you have high levels of ATP in the blood, do you have sufficient energy? I mean, high ATP in the cell, do you have sufficient energy in the cell? Say yes, yeah. Therefore, do you need to be breaking down glycogen to make glucose? No. So high levels of ATP would emphasize, shift this equilibrium more toward the T form. But notice what high levels of AMP. Now, hey, AMP, if you have high levels of AMP in the cell, what does that say about the energy status of the cell? Low. And so rather than waiting for a covalent modification, there's an urgent need for energy within the cell, and that high level of AMP shifts the equilibrium between these two forms more toward the active form, which then turns on this enzyme, which then begins to break down glycogen to make glucose 1-phosphate, which has fates other than going into your blood. It can restore energy within the cell. So notice here, when it's not covalently modified, it's inactive. But depending on the energy status in the cell, you can either make it more inactive or less inactive. Because there is a pool of these enzymes constantly, some in this form, and they're constantly shifting back and forth, depending on the energy status of the cell and of the body. All right, so what comes in here is a signal from insulin. It says, boy, we need a lot of glucose into the blood. Hurry up. I've just been handed a lot of adrenaline. I've got to have a lot of energy. And so what happens is the kinase gets turned on by a mechanism we'll see a little bit. That puts phosphate on that glycogen phosphorylase. At when there's a phosphate on that glycogen phosphorylase, which way does the equilibrium shift? Towards the active, which means that this stuff starts breaking down glycogen in a hurry. All right. Now, so it gets phosphorylated, the equilibrium shifts toward this active form, but nevertheless, is there a covalent effector that can slow down this enzyme? What does it say? Is there a covalent effector that can slow down that enzyme? What is it? Glucose. Glucose can shift the proportion back to the inactive form. Read this caption. It's taken directly from your text. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.